You're about to get lucky with the Bare Naked Money Podcast, the show that gives you the naked truth about personal finance with your hosts, Josh Shelick and Colin White, portfolio managers with Varakin Capital Management, Inc. Welcome to the takeover of the Bare Naked Money Podcast, where we are going to re-engage the book club that we started last year. I think it was last year. Mm-hmm. Feels like 300 years ago, but it was just last year. And today with me is Ainsley Mackey, portfolio manager, Amanda McKenna, associate portfolio manager, and Deandra Camilleri, associate portfolio manager. Do you guys want to introduce yourselves and say a little bit about what your role is?
No.
I'm keeping that in.
Well, you'll get a bit of our personality there.
We have a new book. The last book was called Girls Just Want to Have Funds, F-U-N-D-S. That was a much shorter read than the current book, which is called Thinking in Bets by Annie Duke, which was a little bit longer and denser read, but I did feel like there was a lot more tangible weighted advice that we can put into action.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree.
So I'm going to start us off with a little introduction to the book and to Annie Duke. And I wrote this ahead of time so I would sound professional. Thinking in Bets offers a fascinating look at how to navigate life's uncertainties with the strategic acumen of a professional poker player. Annie Duke is a former World Series of Poker bracelet winner, and she draws on her experience at the card table to illustrate how life, much like poker, is a game of skill, luck, and incomplete information. Duke proposes a revolutionary approach, thinking in bets. This methodology encourages us to embrace uncertainty, evaluate and reevaluate our beliefs, and make better decisions, not just when the stakes are high, but across every aspect of our lives. And really, it's a compelling read for anyone looking to refine their strategic thinking, reduce bias, and approach decisions with a more nuanced and a more nuanced mindset that lives in the realm of probabilities. Annie Duke is not only a renowned professional poker player, but also a skilled author and a consultant in decision strategy. She has a background in cognitive psychology from the University of Pennsylvania. Duke has transitioned her expertise from the poker table to the boardroom, helping individuals and organizations fine-tune their approaches to decision-making and risk management, dedicating her post-poker career to teaching others how to make better decisions in uncertain environments.
I'm going to just ask you guys questions.
Like a book club. Imagine that. The first question is, what were your initial impressions of the book?
Ainsley, I'm going to make you go first.
Oh, darn it. I really quite enjoyed the book, honestly. I never thought of myself as a risk taker, so I never look at things in the consideration of a bet. But she's correct in the fact that every decision I'm making is a bet, because I don't know all the facts. So the book really went through how you can make smarter decisions when you don't have all the facts.
Yeah, and I think it framed betting in a different way for me. It's not, you know, it's betting and gambling maybe are two different concepts almost.
Yeah, there's no money involved. It's, do you have enough information to be able to make the best bet to have the most positive outcome?
What about you, Amanda?
It could apply to many different parts of my life, whether it's professional, how I advise clients, or even in my personal life. Just reading the book, I became more aware of how I make decisions and how these different biases play into my decisions. The main bias that she talks about is resulting. And so that's the idea of focusing on the outcome. And I was like, oh yeah, I definitely do that. As someone who defines himself as a perfectionist, if I don't get the outcome that I thought I was going to get with a decision, then I will beat myself up about it. You have to make sure that you're looking at the process that led to that decision rather than the outcome itself.
Deandra, did you have any other impressions?
I thought it was an interesting concept, especially since, at least for me, a lot of the decisions you make are subconscious. And so it really forces me to think about the choices that I'm making, just everyday, personal, professional. One of the things that stuck out for me was what I'm giving up when I'm making a decision. And the opportunity cost. Like Ainsley said, every time you make a decision, that's a bet. You're betting mm-hmm. on that thing to happen and that everything else that you didn't decide on is not going to happen or it's not the decision you want to make. It's going to change.
So did it challenge or reinforce your existing beliefs about decision making?
It did challenge them. I might not be as quick to make certain decisions. If I had to give an example, I'm not talking about trivial things like where am I going to grab lunch from or just things like, you know, my husband and I recently updated our financial plan for us. And so we had to sit down and really think about what we want to prioritize. And in that exercise, at the same time, you're deciding what you're giving up in order to focus on what you want out of, you know, X amount of years or your retirement. So I think it did challenge the way that I make decisions in terms of existing beliefs about decision making.
What are the key lessons or ideas you took away from the book, Amanda?
I think in general, the key takeaway is this whole concept of thinking events is hard and that it kind of goes against your natural human instinct to rethink your thinking of how you make decisions. It's all about the compounding effect of it, kind of the same, and I was corny with about investing as well. So it's just starting out small, applying some of the strategies from the book and just kind of building on it. And it's okay if you don't, like Annie said it herself, you know, she doesn't always think in bets, but just try to take some of the strategies and apply it to your life, I think will be beneficial.
Yeah.
Deandra?
I can kind of summarize my biggest takeaway in one sentence or one point. It's learning not to judge the quality of a decision with its outcome. So right. Just because you made a decision and it maybe didn't go your way, doesn't necessarily mean your process and the way that you made that decision or the decision itself was the wrong one.
Right.
Because sometimes it doesn't go your way, but it was still the right call in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can imagine emergency room doctors and, you know, learn this lesson pretty early on in their careers, right? Just you have to make the call in the moment with the information you have at hand using the best tools at your disposal for making the decision. And she did allude to that as well. You know, once you've made your choice, you just have to kind of, that's your choice and that's where you're headed. So embrace it and don't think about the option you didn't choose.
Yeah.
And I think that that's probably a wise way to move through the world in many ways. In real world application, how do you see the principles discussed in the book applying to everyday decisions, big and small? Ainsley.
I really like the time travel concept of looking to the past and into the future and zooming yourself out and trying not to focus on the immediate decision, trying to take out some of that emotional impact. So looking at it from 10 minutes from now, say 10 days from now or 10 months from now, is it that big of an impact, whatever decision you're going to make? I like that. I felt like there was a great concentration on talking about truth seeking, actually trying to figure out if the information you have is sufficient to make any decisions and re-examining my own biases. I know that I have beliefs that I just assume are there. She gave a great example of human versus dog years. It's actually not true. There is no scientific fact that a dog ages in 7 years. That's not correct. But I believe it because it's been said so many times. So it was just interesting how we look at the world around us and what we already believe and asking, is that actually the truth?
Yeah, I was shocked by that. I thought 7 years.
So was I. Had to look at that too.
It's like, no. It's got to be true. There's even a calculation you can use for different breeds. So you can get here after 8 years. Yeah, that's funny. That we all had the same reaction to that a little bit of information.
Yeah.
Can you give an example of a decision that you've made since you read the book that you approached in a different way? Anybody?
I have a small one. It's really
I'll
small.
I'll take it. Yeah.
So I'm an early riser most days, but lately I've been rolling over and just turning my football alarm off and snoozing it for, you know, half an hour, 20 minutes. So I started putting my phone across the room.
Yeah.
And so I have to get up, physically walk across the room, get my phone, turn the alarm off. And it was the, I know she talks about Ulysses contracts, and it's sort of that pre-commitment to your future self that you're going to sort of commit to a behavior.
Yeah.
Or a decision. And so that decision is, I want to get up early. And so the way that I do that is put my phone across halfway across the room.
Do you think that there's luck and skill involved in outcomes?
I think there's a bit of both.
Yeah.
I think there has to be a bit of both. She gave golf as an example.
Yeah.
And like for me, I've been golfing for 15 years. And like when you start golfing, it's less skill than it is luck. Like when you hit a good shot, it's by fluke. It's not actually because you knew what you were doing. And as you have more experiences, get more repetition, it becomes more skill and less luck. And you're more saying, oh, I've done the setup. I've got the right club. I did this. But then some guy talked in the background. So that's bad luck. Mm-hmm. So it becomes less about good luck. It becomes about bad luck.
I think there's an element of both. What I struggled with was, and I'm sure everybody struggles with this, is how to tell the difference between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting when you ask somebody about a decision and what, they're based on their response, what they attribute to skill and what they attribute to luck. Like just as Ainsley said, oh, this guy was talking in the background as I was hitting my shot. That's bad luck.
Yeah.
So I found that interesting, but it's definitely a struggle to tell between the two.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting of the statistic about car accidents. So 91% of people who get into a car accident blame the other people. And even 37% when it's a single vehicle accident blame some other external factor. And I'm the opposite. I think everything is my fault. But I found that fascinating that people were like, nah, it's not my fault.
That tree, the pole moved.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's very, like, in the book, she talks about how it's very rare that somebody will say, give somebody else the benefit of the good luck that happened to them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's always, if they succeeded, it's luck, you know, and if they failed, it's because they made crappy decisions. It's, you know, it's hard for us to look at someone and go, oh, they made good choices and landed in a good spot. Mm-hmm. I hope that that's changing. I think that's changing. I don't know if you agree with me. I feel like people are getting nicer.
I'd like to think so, but it seems like everyone is competing with everyone. Well, we can't just say, wow, they did a great job. That's why they've achieved what they've achieved. It seems like there's always this level of competition.
I don't have the energy to compete anymore. It's all gone. The book talks a lot about dealing with uncertainty in decision-making. How do we, as individuals, handle uncertainty in decision-making? And has the book influenced the way you look at that uncertainty? Ainsley, you want to start then?
So the more information allows us the opportunity to have more discussion, more collaboration, finding out more information from other people to be able to adjust our beliefs and make the most educated decision possible. So to me, uncertainty is a good thing. We should never be saying we're 100% sure in anything because you can't be.
Right. And I think embracing the idea of uncertainty actually is a bit of our superpower. We cannot be certain of anything. That's the one thing we can be certain of. So we can't be certain.
Correct.
Yeah, the world is too complex and unpredictable. So as long as you have that sound process, then it's, you have to be at peace with not knowing how things are going to turn out. And for me, I struggle with that a little bit because I am a planner. I like to plan things. Ever since I was a child, I planned my own birthday parties. So I'm not joking. Ask my mother. So yeah, just being at peace with, you've done what you can do, and the rest you just have to let it be. So that was kind of a reminder for me.
And Deandra, what insights did you gain about cognitive biases and how they impact our decisions from this book? I know that in our industry, we may be more aware of cognitive bias than folks outside the industry, just by virtue of what we do. But did this book change your thoughts, give you more insight?
One thing has brought to my attention on the professional side of my life, recognizing some of these biases when we're dealing with clients can really impact the advice that we're giving them. And when we recognize maybe if a bias is present, it sends a flag up in terms of, hey, there's a little bit of bias happening and how to properly address it. So to give an example, well, some younger clients, they prioritize the now instead of the future. And I think that was temporal discounting she had talked about in the book. And not necessarily just younger clients, just maybe clients prioritizing the now instead of later. So when you see something like that happening, you can see the bias that maybe the focus is the immediate and not the future and how to address that. And you can provide advice accordingly, because I have had instances where clients will get to retirement or they're looking to retire. And because they focused on the now for so long, maybe they have to keep working for a few years, or they can't retire as soon as they would have liked or spend as much as they would have liked in retirement. And so I think being aware of these biases and how they can show up when we're dealing with clients is really important.
Yeah. Yeah. And sort of being able to distance yourself from the outcome and analyze your process almost as a third party and look back and see. And she talked about the one of the great poker players who had won a tournament and just dominated the tournament and then went away and picked apart everything he had done and had other people pick apart everything he had done because he recognized that there are ways to improve the process.
If you talk to, I know when I started investing at 15, 16, I couldn't actually open up an account until I was 18. But when somebody's maybe just starting out to invest, and let's say they do really well, their first year, they think that, oh my gosh, I can do this. I'm as good as, a lot of the firms and managers out there. And then usually what happens is as you go through the market cycles, sort of reality hits in a little bit. And they'll be brought down to earth. I know it happened to me, and it sort of put things in perspective. But things like that are also a bias too, right? And that goes back to resulting. So you have this unreal year in terms of return, and you think, I'm a genius. I can do this. And as soon as something goes awry, it's, oh well, look at all the factors that are impacting the market. I can't control any of those. That's why I had a bad year. And so I just find that interesting when you talk to a lot of do-it-yourself investors that maybe aren't aware of things like that. Just something I wanted to mention.
Let's just pause for a minute and address the fact that you were 15 when you started investing. You're a bit weird.
Nerd.
Yeah. Couldn't even open up an account, so I had to do sort of demo accounts. And I think my dad had accounts, and so I would we would put money in there, and I'd help make the sort of the decisions. I know it's probably not your normal sort of, if it makes you feel better, Josh started at 12. So
yes, I'm not surprised by that.
I knew that one. That's interesting. So I find there are some folks in our industry who really just are super like into it and start really early. And then there's the super responsible Ainsley. I know you started very young with your first job, and Amanda, I'm sure that's true for you as well. Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah.
Amanda was probably planning birthday parties in grade school.
Yeah,
I was. She went with my party planning business. So, I just wanted to piggyback too on Deandra talking about these biases. The other one that stuck out to me was the loss aversion bias, where it feels two times worse losing as it feels good winning. And we see this all the time with clients that they'll reach out when the markets are down, but when they're doing well in their account, we don't hear from them. So it's being aware of that and guiding clients through this process and saying it definitely hurts and feels worse when you're down, but eventually it'll come back around.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because that's so true of everything. What was your favorite example or anecdote in the book? We'll start with you, Amanda.
Amanda and I are probably going to have the same one.
Oh, okay. No, you say the David Letterman one. I was going to say, I don't know why, but the Night Jerry versus Day Jerry reference really stood out.
Yeah, that resonated
with me.
And just because I grew up watching Seinfeld with my dad, so I could just picture it.
Yeah.
But so that analogy, again, Deandra, you talked about it earlier about temporal discounting. Night Jerry gets to stay up and have fun, and then Day Jerry gets to pay the consequences. And then the whole idea that taking advantage of what's here and now rather than thinking about your future and the consequences of your actions today.
Yeah. And okay, what's the Letterman thing, Deandra?
So there was a show back in the day called The Hills. I'm sure many people have heard of it. And a long time ago, when it was at its peak, Lauren Conrad went on The Late Show with David Letterman. And so just to a very high level, there was a whole bunch of drama in the show, which I'm not going to go into. And the debate was whether it was everybody around her or if she was the problem. And so on the show, you know, they're discussing the drama and Letterman actually says, well, do you think maybe it's you that's the problem? And she got taken aback, as I'm sure a lot of people would.
Mm-hmm.
And what I thought was really interesting about that particular example is Annie walks us through the process of not being, when you're not ready to hear a truth and someone gives it to you, what happens or the ramifications of that. And that was a perfect example. She may very well have known that she was the issue or she had a hand in sort of some of the drama, but she wasn't in the mental state to have that discussion about it. And so I think when we're making decisions and giving people feedback and telling other people truths, we always have to be aware of the fact as whether they want to put themselves in a position or in a position to accept that. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's going to cause a lot of friction and a lot of conflict.
That's why this book is made for anybody.
You
can be someone that's never played poker before, doesn't get football, baseball references. You know, but they've got The Hills in there. They've got Seinfeld. So she makes it very relatable.
Yeah. That driver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very, very digestible book, I found.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Your favorite anecdote or example?
Yeah. And my favorite was by far the Super Bowl of 2015. Seahawks, the decision, very last play of the game, which they ended up losing. They decided to throw the ball instead of handing it off to Marshawn Lynch, who'd had an epic season, and literally the emotion in that arena, the emotion by everyone watching when the call was made to throw the ball and they fumbled and they lost on the 1 yard line was traumatic. Like my boyfriend's a Seahawks fan, so we'd watched every playoff game. It was like things were over. Someone had died. And the reaction was, why on earth would you ever make that play? But if you look at sports analytics, all the coaches, they have all the stats. If we do this, this, or this, the percentage is this type of outcome will happen. And Pete Carroll made the call that he should have made. It just had a bad outcome.
Mm-hmm.
But even now, like 2 weeks ago, we had the announcement that Pete Carroll is stepping back from his coaching role with the Seahawks. The first thing I did, I immediately Googled legacy Pete Carroll. And I wanted to see. And the headline was, I pulled it up here. Pete Carroll's legacy is more than a one play call, but will that Super Bowl goal line decision keep him from the Hall of Fame? That was the top headline.
Yeah.
This was from 2015. They'd already won the Super Bowl. He'd been coaching for over a decade, one of the oldest coaches in the NFL, but his entire career had discounted for one call that wasn't necessarily a bad call.
Right. Yeah. He used the information and tools he had to make what was the most logical choice with the highest percentage chance of working out. So.
And really, since that game and actually the reference to the White Sox when they had the World Series game jeopardized, sports analytics has become huge. Like anyone who does fantasy football, they have every stat for literally every play for the last decade. So yeah, it takes out the emotion. However, it's hard to understand when a play goes bad.
Those things make me so sad when somebody makes a call like that. And then that's because I can put myself in that emotional position of how terrible you would feel and having all that hate.
And still, how many years later, he's still getting questioned about it.
Yeah. Were there any aspects of the book or ideas that you disagreed with or you felt were underdeveloped?
Anybody?
Deandra, you look like you have a thought there about it.
Nothing overly concrete. I just, sometimes I found that she was illustrating a lot of ideas at once. And so I sort of had to sift through all of the different examples and research just to sort of come back to her core themes.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the overall value of the book is in terms of what it could do for pretty much anybody? Ainsley?
I think it's trying to give you the tools to be able to examine the decisions that you're making, have some truth-seeking in everything that you're doing, re-examine yourself, your belief, because you quite often don't know the belief that you've got built in, reminding you that having a diversity of perspectives will help you make better decisions, that it's not just one person out there trying to make those decisions. And again, I really like the fact that you can declare that you're uncertain on something, that it doesn't mean that you're not smart, that you're not making the right decision. It's just you don't know all the facts.
Yeah. Yeah. Amanda?
Just an add. I agree with what Ainsley said, but the other thing is to keep you accountable too. Especially where she talks about the whole buddy system, having those, I think she calls it a pod, truth-seeking pod, having those people, you have this, whether it's written or verbal agreement, that you guys are going to work together and be honest with each other, keep each other accountable. And I think that really helps with making these better decisions in your life.
I like the buddy system and the fact, too, that they can call you out on your biases. Right. And you really don't want to have a group of people who are all like-minded.
You've got
you need that diversification to be able to say, oh, wait a second, I hadn't thought of that potential outcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Overall, it was, if we look at it like a self-help book, which it kind of is, it's I think out of all of the books that have been recommended to me that I pretended to read or have not read. over the years, and this one I was forced to read, but I do think it was forced to read for work reasons. I think this one will have one of the bigger impacts on my day-to-day life, just because there were so many excellent examples. So she illustrated it so clearly that you can take what she's laid out and apply it to your life. Very, very, it's almost like just pick up the cookie cutter, put it down. So I think it's the most relatable of this sort of genre book I've read. And I think anybody would enjoy it. I mean, there's the four of us, although we work for the same company and in the same industry, we have very, very different roles and we have very, very different personalities. And if all four of us were able to take something away from the book, I think that that speaks to the book's overall value.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Anybody have any additional thoughts about the book?
We talked about how you can apply the buddy system in our careers as advisors and dealing with clients. How it applies to that situation is, you know, clients will come to us with ideas or decisions, and it's up to us to be truthful and honest with their decision and bounce ideas off of them and how to come to the right decision. Even with questions like, when do I retire? It's like we are the person that gives you all the facts and removes the emotion out of the decision. And then it's working with the client to help them come to that decision.
I think that that's a pretty accurate takeaway from the book, that any sort of good advisor in your life can function in that same way. Deandra, do you have anything to add on that one?
The only thing is maybe accountability. So I know some clients will come to you with sort of a decision already made in their head. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, hey, you know, I'm thinking of doing this, or I'd like to do this. And I can give hundreds of examples, but just I want to say general here. And when that sort of happens, it's, you know, our job to also challenge anything that maybe we don't agree with or doesn't make sense for the client. And at the same time, you know, I've had clients also say, you know, I want to pay want to pay down my mortgage a bit this year. Can you check in with me in 3-4 months just to follow up? I'm going to follow up with you in 3-4 months and say, hey, you know, did you end up paying something towards your mortgage? Mm-hmm. And they usually either say, you know what? No, but thank you for putting it in, you know, top of mind. I'm going to get that done. And then they go ahead and sort of, you know, we act as sort of that reminder. They're going to check in with me. They're holding me accountable for this decision that I want to make. So we can hold clients accountable for decisions that they want to make. And they maybe sort of need that extra guidance or that push to get there. Yeah.
Yeah. So you help them remove that. Well, what is it? Temporal discounting?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we've covered everything. Is there anything else anybody wants to add? We're good. All right. I think that's it.
If you're breaking a sweat trying to figure out what your financial advisor is talking about, you're not getting the service you need. You probably hate trying to get an answer from them, but you also think moving your accounts will be a headache. And it might be. But working with don'trocktheboatwealthplanning.com or .ru isn't exactly stress-free, is it? Call us. We will demystify the world for you.